Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
We're happy to be partnering with Red Hen Press tonight and bringing you this evening's program. We also have Red Hen's founding editor and director, Kate Gale, with us tonight. Kate founded Red Hen Press in 1994 as a collective, publishing herself and fellow writers Marlene Joyce Pearson, Ricardo Means Ibarra, Benjamin Saltman, and Angela Ball. Later, the press was reorganized as a nonprofit, embarking upon the good work of building and supporting an active and vital writing community in Los Angeles. In the wake of the demise of Black Sparrow Press and Sun and Moon, Red Hen has become one of the largest independent presses in Southern California. They publish 20 titles a year of poetry, literary fiction, and nonfiction. Red Hen has established a Writing in the Schools program and its reading series at the Ruskin Art Club, and the Geffen Playhouse hosts such writers as Carolyn C., John Retchie, C.D. Wright, Lee Young Lee, Joy Harjo, Chris Abani, Al Young, Robert Shear, Paul Cummins, and Marvin Bell. A literary provocateur, and I should add impresario too, Kate received both her bachelor's and master's degrees in English with emphasis in creative writing and a PhD in American Lit from Claremont Graduate University. She is a poet herself and author of 4 books of poetry, a novel, and a bilingual children's book. She is also the editor of 3 literary anthologies and has recently completed the libretto for the opera Rio de Sangre by Don Davis. She has been a visiting poet at Pomona College and has taught in the Graduate Humanities Program at Mount St. Mary's. She teaches publishing courses at Antioch. She speaks at universities, writing conferences, and MFA programs on independent publishing, editing, and publicity. And tonight, she will be introducing our poets. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Kate Gale to the Los Angeles Central Library.
I'm very happy to be here tonight, and I'm very glad that Allowed continues to have these wonderful programs here. You should all go on the Allowed website and see what kinds of events are going on here, everything from science events, political events, to literary events, events that people will speak about things that you'll disagree with and that you'll agree with, but you will always have something to talk about. So we're very, very grateful to be here. And one of the things I love about being here that I was just telling Justin is that I always see friends here, but I always see a lot of new faces. And so it feels to me like this is sort of a gathering place of all kinds of people who like being part of the world of ideas. The first person who's reading here tonight is Elise Passion. This is her book, Bestiary. And when I first read Elise Passion's work, she was with a press called Storyline. And I felt that she was just breaking open ground in terms of what she was doing with language. And so when she sent us a manuscript, I was very excited to read it, and I was not disappointed. This book was published this year, February 2009, and she has a book, Infidelities, winner of the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize, and Houses. Houses is another one of her books. Her poems have appeared in The New Republic, Plowshares, and Shenandoah, among other magazines and in numerous anthologies. She's the editor of the New York Times bestselling anthology, Poetry Speaks to Children, and co-editor of Poetry Speaks, Poetry Speaks Expanded, Poetry in Motion, and Poetry in Motion from Coast to Coast. She's the former executive director of the Poetry Society of America. She teaches writing in the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. So she flew in from Chicago to read here today. I'm sure she's enjoying the weather. Please welcome Elise Passion.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you all for being here this evening. Many thanks to Red Hen Press and Central Public Library for inviting me to read here. I'm honored to share the stage with B.H. Fairchild. I'm going to begin by reading three poems from Infidelities. Dreams often influence my poems. Sometimes an entire poem may be inspired by a dream. In this case, a dream enters at the poem's end. Confederacy. Wear the heart like a home, as in Patsy Cline's song, "What We're Two-Stepping To, My Heart Worn on His Sleeve." It's Nashville, and I'm in a spin, a stranger's arms. Commandeering my moves, he inquires, "Where's your home?" I confuse home for heart, since revolving with him is like sipping slow gin. Because he is a soldier, I swallow every line of his Confederacy, while we ignore the dance floor's grooves, whirl round, then dip, his fingers digging deep in my spine's gully. But my heart is on hold as it beats against his regimentals, then stops. His badge strikes my heart home. On the edge of surrender, I open up my heart just to see if he'll scare. I describe the gunman in my room every night at my bed, taking aim, about to fire the shot, which never hits its mark, but wakes me instead. He occupies, I say, my home, my heart. And this next poem is an anti-love spell. Can everybody hear me okay? It's okay. Incantation. To light the dark of you where no light has explored, to trek the deserts, accept mirages, swim gulfs, inhabit the islands, caves, the rooms and alcoves of you, the chambers, to chart the arteries, to join the valves, the bolts, the nails, to open windows, hazard exits, fall through trap floors, to upend drawers, slam doors, to shatter the glass of you, but waking, sleeping, to learn to say no more to you. I wrote this next poem after participating in a Native Writers Conference in Norman, Oklahoma, and the poem attempts to explore notions of identity. Two standards. Jones, 1/8. I'm 1/4. When we walk into Billy's, I want to look like her, full Osage. "You wouldn't find an Indian here," she tells me, "if not for the conference." And the cigar-chewing driver shuttling in from the Will Rogers Airport confides, "I never seen so many Indians all in one spot." The bar's packed like a bar should be. Joan shows me off, introducing her friends to a light-haired, East Coast-educated outsider whose mother, Betty Tallchief, is Oklahoma's pride. "At that table are some Osages you should meet. They know my relatives in Fairfax, though they come from Pawhuska, Pawnee." Angela says the Tallchiefs, the keepers of the drum, will host the Osage dances next June. "Will you join us? You'll be given your Osage name." Even though my grandmother Tallchief's daughters became famous as ballet dancers, she displayed photographs of my mother and aunt when they were 12, 11, in Osage ceremonial dress performing at a powwow. My mother said her father's mother taught her those dances. I say, when asked, I never wanted to dance. But here in Billy's, with the jukebox repeating the Beatles' Twist and Shout, all I want is to dance and to adopt my mother's Osage name, Wakse Thunba, two standards. All I want is to return to Oklahoma and answer Angela, yes, though New York City's half a continent away. I am my mother's daughter, two standards. And tonight, forgetting my given name, I will take that ancestral one. I'll now read some poems from my new book called Bestiary, which means Book of Beasts. And in this book, I'm interested in crossing thresholds between human and animal, ocean and land, life and death. I've just read a poem about being Osage, and I've spent time researching a particular period of Osage history called the Osage Reign of Terror, when outsiders married Osage women and then killed them for their head rights. This next poem is spoken by Molly Burkhart, whose sister, Anna Kyle Brown, was murdered during the Osage Reign of Terror. And the title is Wigia, and Wigia means prayer in Osage. So it's dedicated to Anna Kyle Brown, Osage, 1896 to 1921, Fairfax, Oklahoma. Because she died where the ravine falls into water, because they dragged her down to the creek. In death, she wore her blue broadcloth skirt. Though frost blanketed the grass, she cooled her feet in the spring. Because I turned the log with my foot, her slippers floated downstream into the dam. Because after the thaw, the hunters discovered her body. Because she lived without our mother. Because she had inherited head rights for oil beneath the land. She was carrying his offspring. The sheriff disguised her death as whiskey poisoning. Because when he carved her body up, he saw the bullet hole in her skull. Because when she was murdered, the leg clutchers bloomed, but then froze under the weight of frost. During Saka Zika Tsetha, the killer of the flower's moon, I will wade across the river of the blackfish, the otter, the beaver. I will climb the bank where the willow never dies. I see this next poem as an ars poetica, which means a poem about writing poetry. Monarch. From milkweed to lupin, a woman shadows a monarch, slowly makes her way, conveys her weight with care. Inside the womb, her son flutters, then butterfly kicks against walls. The woman tracks a trail of burnished wings migrating into the heart notch of forest, then settles on a lichened tree trunk where underground rivers flowing out of snow mountain lakes rumble the decree of her unborn son. Journey farther, journey deeper. Into darker woods, she transports a monarch ruling even now, unnamed territory. And this next poem is a truncated sonnet with a myth at its core. Birth. Armored in red, Her voice commands every corner. Bells gong on squares, in steeples, answering the prayers. Bright tulips crown the boulevards. Pulled from the womb, she imitates that mythic kick from some god's head. She roars, and we are conquered. Her legs, set free, combat the air. Naked warrior, she is our own. Entire empires are overthrown. And I think it's pretty safe to say that anyone in a relationship has probably experienced a moment like this one in Disappearing Act, I think especially when you have small children. And this next poem is a villanelle. And I'd always wanted to write a villanelle, and this one happened very quickly. Disappearing Act. The elsewhere husband doesn't care. Inside their life, she's on her own, inhabiting the house, the air. They share their meal, both unaware, each one distracted by the phone. The elsewhere husband doesn't care. After his work, he climbs the stair, tumbles with children not yet grown. She dives through sky into the air. Unmoved by the new shade of hair or those lost pounds down to the bone, the elsewhere husband doesn't care. At the opera, how debonair the gestures of the baritone. But no, she smiles, inhales the air. Why not embark on an affair? She has the time, she is alone. The elsewhere husband doesn't care, while she vanishes into air. So I'm reading some poems tonight that I never read, but I'm in California, so my friend with whom I'm staying has encouraged me. That was one of them, and this is the next one. As I mentioned before in Two Standards, my mother is Osage and was a prima ballerina, and I grew up in the ballet world, and this next poem is about transitions. I write poems mostly in form, and this one is sort of long, sprawling prose lines. So really like a prose poem, but in couplets. The Broken Swan. When my mother's body is seized with uncontrollable twitching, she begins to reminisce about dancing in Venice. When the soft-spoken nurse with the long black braid positions her head for the EEG, my mother quips she is finally having her hair done. My mother begins talking about Japan, how they would pray, kneeling on tatami mats, how the Japanese were her most devoted fans. She explains to all of us, gathered around her hospital bed, the nurses, the residents, the interns, the neurologist, about raw fish, as if we have never before heard of sushi or sashimi. And she chats about sake, as if it were 1958 again, and how her partner, Andrei Glevsky, drank sake before Swan Lake and during a corsage lift, let her drop. Then she describes the gondoliers in their barges waiting on the canals, how when my father arrived at the gritty palace dressed in worn-down jeans, she worried the concierge would turn us away. I catch a glimpse of my mother, the woman I had seen last week on PBS during a 70s interview, older than I am now, but looking years younger, wearing blue eyeshadow, saying, if I am able to be beautiful and graceful or regal or dramatic, then I have accomplished what I set out to do as a ballet dancer. In the hospital, I witnessed the mother I had known in all her imperial elegance, who practices the phrases she once had taught, saying, thank you, love, and how are you, angel, and are you comfortable? Not the woman she has become since my father died, every day wearing the same black t-shirt, demanding, "Where are my pills?" or "Turn on the TV." Under the glare of fluorescent lights, my mother arches her neck as if on stage, feathering before her rapt audience. I'm going to read two more poems. And this one now is about my father. Ash. "There's a moth trapped inside the fire," my daughter says, but I explain, "No, it's an ash." She asks, "Like Papa?" A month before we had transported my father's ashes on a plane to Oklahoma. When we boarded, airport security insisted on viewing my father's remains inside the urn. After they pried the lid, the crack kept fissuring. The day before my father died, a tree surgeon hacked down the ash, which towered tall above our house. Struck by lightning, the tree had split in two, about to strike the roof. My father, cut down by disease, could no longer swallow or speak, yet he wanted to sit upright in his cane-back chair. I knelt on the oak floor, holding his gnarled hands. We shuddered to hear the buzzsaw chop down the branches. Early June. Outside my father's house, the wood shavings hovered in air like moths. I was appointed the Poet Laureate of Three Oaks, Michigan, and I was asked to write a poem about winter. And here is my last poem. Pond in Winter. Throughout the night, deliberate steps of mammals leave an impression upon the sheer sheet of pond, where the great blue heron once dipped its beak, where the wood frogs jumped from the hands of the children, where, in the dead of summer, a northern water snake coiled on the bank, alive in the sunlight, but now lies buried beneath the glass. Where do the fish escape, the minnows, the bluegill? Angels inhabit the willow trees where orb-web spiders wove their evanescent graves. Above the house, a secret of smoke. The wood burns inside the grate as it once smoldered under leaves. From the winter forest, a solitary light rises through a window in thick dusk, as if surfacing again out of water. Thank you so much.
Next reader will be back in 1 minute, and if I were a comedian, I would say something really entertaining, but I have been missing my Dave Chappelle lessons, so I'm not sure I can do that. But that was a wonderful reading, Elise. I love hearing those poems that I've read over and over, and it's when you hear them out loud, you feel that sort of echo of them in the air, and that's just fabulous. I remember when I first met you, watching you walk across the hotel in Chicago and thinking, ah, she still walks like a dancer. Even though I knew you had said you didn't dance, but you still had that sort of regal walk. So I think maybe you inherited that. Yes. Do you want to explain what the structure of a villanelle is, Elise?
Villanelle is based on one refrain that keeps repeating
And it's pretty old, yes? I'm trying to think. Right. Her mom was a secret person. So it is my great pleasure to be introducing B.H. Fairchild. He grew up in small towns in Texas, Oklahoma, so another Oklahoma connection here in southwest Kansas. He's the author of The Arrival of the Future, Local Knowledge, and The Art of the Lathe, a finalist for the National Book Award, and he's the winner of the Kingsley Tufts Award, the William Carlos Williams Award, the California Book Award, the Penn Center West Poetry Award, and an award from the Texas Institute of Letters. He's a recipient of Guggenheim, Rockefeller, Bellagio, and NEA fellowships, and he recently received the Arthur Rents Poetry Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Like many people who love poetry, when I first started reading Fairchild's poetry, what amazed me the most was that he was writing about people I knew. It didn't feel to me like this sort of poetry that was steeped in the academy, that was using language I didn't understand. It didn't feel like a puzzle. He was writing about people driving badly in cars, something I can relate to and do every day. And people working with their hands and building things. And I felt like I was just entering this whole new space where I knew these people, I knew this language, and yet it was still somehow fabulous. Please welcome B.H. Fairchild.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I really appreciate Red Hen Books and Aloud for bringing me here. And it's a special honor to be reading with Elise Passion. And there's a story behind that, which I will begin with. There are, I think, in every poet's life, certainly in any poet's life who did not grow up in a highly cultured household, because you will think back years later, how did I get into this insanity, you know? I mean, I certainly grew up in a part of the country and in a sort of social class where boys just did not grow up to be poets. And so looking back, there actually are moments sort of like what Wordsworth calls spots of time, except they're aesthetic spots of time. And you know, these are the things that made you turn out to be, if not a poet, some kind of artist. At some time, you fell in love with beauty. I know that sounds like the beginning of a gay autobiography, but but it's not. But looking back, I mean, there are moments such as when I was a child watching my father. He was a lathe machinist, and seeing him work at the lathe. And there was a real beauty in that, though I would not have been able to use the word at that time. First time I was involved in a double play in Little League Baseball, the whole business of having your body disappear inside emotion, which must be something like a dancer feels. That was an aesthetic moment. Reading a biography of a grizzly by Ernest Seton Thompson was certainly one of those moments. And then another moment. And I could have had no idea it would affect me so deeply, but believe me, this is why this particular reading means so much to me. It did affect me profoundly. I was 5 years old when we were visiting my aunt and uncle in Fairfax, Oklahoma, and my sister, 5 years older than me, was taking ballet lessons. And so my aunt said, oh, they're having this wonderful ballerina come in from New York to dance downtown. Wouldn't you like to see that? And I hated my sister momentarily for saying, yes, we'd love to see that. But I had to go with her. I didn't want to. It was a little one-screen downtown movie theater in small-town Oklahoma. And we went in, and I believe it was some short selection from Swan Lake that she was dancing to. And unbelievable when you realize who I'm talking about here. But there was actually one of those old portable phonographs that would play 78s. And yes, back when they had records. Okay, wake up here. Records. And they had some scratchy old record that had an excerpt from Swan Lake. And it started playing. And then the tallest woman I had ever seen in my life, because I had never seen a dancer on point before, came out on the stage, and it was absolutely unforgettable. And the woman's name was, as you've guessed, Maria Tallchief. And I never forgot that. And Maria Tallchief has appeared in three of my poems. But again, you have to understand that it's an important aesthetic moment in my life that makes it so moving for me now to be, I mean, how does life work this way? To be reading with her very talented daughter, who has become, of course, a very accomplished artist in her own right. But the first poem I will read, actually, is a poem in which Maria Tallchief appears. This is in a form called a sestina, which literally millions of workshop students have grown sick of because it's often an assignment. And this is about a dancer from Nebraska whose mother was a ballet teacher. And she finally, ran away from home. There's a description in the first stanza of this choreographer from Nebraska, and then in the second stanza, and then throughout the poem, she begins to speak. There is constant movement in my head. The choreographer from Nebraska is listening to her mother's cane hammering the dance floor down, down, like some gaunt, rapacious bird digging at a rotted limb. The mother still beats time in the daughter's head. There is constant movement in my head, the choreographer begins. In Nebraska, I learned dance and guilt from my mother, held my hands out straight until the cane beat my palms blue. I was a wild bird crashing into walls, calming down only to dance. When Tallchief came down from New York, a dream flew into my head. To be 6 feet tall, to dance the Firebird all in black and red, to shock Nebraska with my naked, crazy leaps until the cane shook in the furious hand of my mother. Well, that day never came. My mother thought I could be whittled down, an oak stump to carve into some cane she could lean on. But in my head were the sandhill cranes that cross Nebraska each fall. Sluggish, great winged birds lumbering from our pond, the air bird heavy with cries and thrumming. My mother knew. She said I would leave Nebraska. That small town life could only pull me down. Then her hands flew up around her head and she hacked at the air with her cane. There are movements I can't forget. The cane banging the floor, dancers like huge birds struggling into flight, and overhead, the choreography of silver cranes my mother always watched when the wind blew down from the sandhills and leaves fell on Nebraska. This dance is the cane of my mother. The dancers are birds that will never come down. They were all in my head when I left Nebraska. Thank you. I've just noticed that I forgot to bring the water in from the green room, and so this is what we call a dry reading. I happen to have a new book coming out next month, and so I thought I would read several poems from it. The very first poem in the book is called The Gray Man, and it's about a man I worked with back when I worked in my father's machine shop. He was the scariest man I've ever been around, certainly the scariest man I ever worked with. I think he was probably Eastern European, but he had this gray cast to his face as if he had just gotten back up out of his coffin, you know. In fact, I remember one of the popular movies in was A Night of the Living Dead. I guess so I was prepared by popular culture for this encounter. but the fact was that the shop was located on the edge of town on Highway 54, which was the main north-south route down to Route 66, where everybody wanted to get to so they could go to where? Here. And so a lot of hitchhikers, and they would often ask my father for a job for a week or 2 weeks. Oh, thank you so much. And so whenever he'd hire one, I was the guy who had to work with him, you know. And it was like, in this case, I was about 13 years old, working with this guy who I thought was prepared to kill me at any moment. The Gray Man. We are cutting weeds and sunflowers on the shoulder, the gray man and I. Red dust coiling up around us, muddying our sweat-smeared mugs, clogging our hair, the iron heel of an August Kansas sun pushing down on the sighs we raise against it and swing down in an almost homicidal rage and drunken weariness. And I keep my distance. He's a new hire just off the highway, a hitchhiker sick to death of hunger, the cruelties of the road, and our boss hates poverty just enough to hire it. Even this old man, a dead, leaden pall upon his skin so vile it makes you pull away. The gray trousers and state-issue black prison boots, the bloodless, grim, unmoving lips, and the eyes set in concrete. Dark hallways that lead to darker rooms down somewhere in the basement of the soul's despair. 2 weeks. He hasn't said a word. He's a goddamn ghost, I tell my father. Light flashes from his scythe as he decapitates big clumps of yellow blooms, a flailing, brutal war against the lords of labor, I suppose, against the state, the world, himself, who knows. When we break, I watch the canteen's water bleed from the corners of his mouth, a spreading wound across his shirt, the way he spits into the swollen pile of bluestem and rank bindweed as if he hates it and everything that grows, a hatred that has roots and thickens, twisting, snarled around itself. A lizard wanders into sunlight, and he hacks at it, chopping clods until dust clouds rise like mist around him. And then he speaks, in a kind of shattering of glass cutting through the hot wind sigh, the fear. Love thine enemy. He says it to the weeds, or maybe what they stand for. Then knees buckling, with a rasping, gutted sob as if drowning in that slew of dirty air, he begins, trembling, to cry. I was a boy. The plains wind leaned against the uncut weeds. High wires hummed with human voices in their travail. And the highway I had worked but never traveled lay across the fields and vanished in that distant gray where day meets night. The second poem in the book is actually the first poem of a three-part longer sequence simply called Trilogy. But this first poem is actually about a former resident of Los Angeles who died back around 1970. She was only expected to live, I think, maybe up until her late 20s or whatever, because she was a woman who was born without arms or legs. And so she made her living. She died in her 70s. She made her living appearing in what we, much to our shame, back in those days called freak shows. She worked with, well, I will read you the epigraph from the obituary from the Los Angeles Times, and I need to credit my wife, actually, for showing me this obituary, and then it's set on the, I cut it out, set on the refrigerator for several years, and then I finally wrote the poem. But her name was Frida Pushnick. Little Frida Pushnick, the armless, legless girl wonder, who spent years as a touring attraction for Ripley's Believe It or Not and Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. In the poem, she is speaking. And you might think that maybe her speech is unduly educated, but the fact is that she was a marvelously read woman. Apparently, they had invented some device for her, I think, which she held in her mouth, which she could turn the pages of a book. I hope, you know, when she appeared, she was actually reading a book that her audience was unable to fathom, perhaps, you know. But I'm sure it didn't happen that way. And actually, she could write with this, and she won several penmanship competitions. But in fact, she did pretty well, and she retired actually in her mid-40s to a very nice home on the coast in Southern California. She really attracted me because of what she would say to people who had the rudeness to ask things like, you know, how do you feel about your life? And she would actually say things like, it's been wonderful. I've been so lucky. And one time she was asked by a reporter, and this took a lot of rudeness, but he said, aren't you a little bit ashamed of appearing in a freak show, making your money from showing off your disadvantages? And she said, not as long as there's money in it. I read that and I thought, yeah, that's the way to be. Frida Pushnick. These are the faces I love. Adrift with wonder, big-eyed as infants and famished for that strangeness in the world they haven't known since childhood. They are monsters of innocence who gladly shoulder the burden of the blessed, the unbroken, the beautiful, the lost. They should be walking on their lovely knees like pilgrims to that shrine in Guadalupe where I fail to draw a crowd. I might even be their weird little saint, though God knows I've wanted everything they've wanted and more, of course. When we toured Texas west from San Antonio, those tiny cow towns flung like pearls from the broken necklace of the Rio Grande, I looked out on a near infinity of rangeland and far blue mountains, avatars of emptiness, minor gods of that vast and impossibly pure nothing to whom I spoke my little stillborn ritual prayer. I'm not on those posters they paste all over town, those silent orgies of secondary colors, jade, burnt orange, purple, each one a shrieking anthem to the exotic. Bengal tigers, ubiquitous as alley cats, raw with not inhuman but superhuman beauty. Demonic spider monkeys, absurdly buxom dancers clad in gossamer, and spiritual gray elephants, trunks raised like arms to Allah. Franciscan murals of plenitude, brute vitality ripe with the fruit of Eros, the faint blush of sin, and I am not there. Rather, My role is the unadvertised, secret, wholly unexpected thrill you find within, a discovery, irresistible, like sex. So here I am. The crowd leaks in, halting, unsure, a bit like mourners at a funeral, but without the grief. And there is always something damp, interior, and, well, sticky about them. Cotton candy soles that smear the bad air, funky, bleak. All quite forgettable, except for three. A woman, middle-aged, plain and unwrinkled as her Salvation Army uniform. Bland as oatmeal, but with this heavy, leaden sorrow pulling at her eyelids and the corners of her mouth. Front row four times, weeping constantly, then looking up, lips moving in a silent prayer, I think, and blotting tears with a kind of practiced automatic movement, somehow suggesting that the sorrow is her own and I'm her mirror now, the little well of suffering from which she drinks. A minister once told me to embrace my sorrow. To hell with that, I said, embrace your own. And then there was that nice young woman, Arbus, who came and talked brilliantly, took hours setting up the shot, then said, I'm very sorry, and just walked away. The way the sunlight plunges through the opening at the top around the center tent pole, like a spotlight cutting through the smutty air, and it fell on him, the third, a boy of maybe 16, hardly grown, sitting in the fourth row, not too far, but not too close, red hair flaring numinous, ears big as hands, gray eyes that nail themselves to mine. My mother, I remember, looked at me that way, and a smile, not quite a smile. He came twice. And that second time, just before I thanked the crowd, I'm so glad you could drop by. Please tell your friends. His hand rose, floated really, to his chest. It was a wave, the slightest, shyest wave. Goodbye, hello, what's the difference anyway? As if he knew me, truly knew me. As if someday he might return. His eyes, his hair, as vivid as the turbans on those elephants in the posters where I'm not. That day the crowd seemed to slither out, to ooze, I thought, like reptiles, sluggish, sleek, gut-hungry for the pleasures of the world. The prize, the magic number, the winning shot, the doll from the rifle booth, the girl he gives it to, the snow cone dripping, the popcorn dyed with all the colors of the rainbow, the sky it crowns, and whatever lies beyond, the one, perhaps, we're told, enthroned there, who in love or rage or spasm of inscrutable desire made that teeming, oozing, devouring throng born now into the midway sunlight, that vanished and forever silent God to whom I say again my little prayer, let me be one of them. The book, which is called Usher, ends with a poem in which I am ushering in a movie theater back in my hometown, and I'm about 14 years old. I look back and I can hardly believe it. I mean, you don't have ushers at movie theaters anymore except for the big fancy ones over in Hollywood, but it's amazing to me that back then, even in my little town, one little theater, they had ushers, and they had these snappy little uniforms for us to wear, and we would stand there and conduct people to their seats. I mean, it's amazing to me that they weren't interested in cutting costs, you know, and didn't know that the 40 or 50 people who would attend at the peak moment would be perfectly able to find their own seats, you know. But we would turn the flashlight on and go down the aisle and show them to their seat. So this is me, and the movie is On the Waterfront, which I always assume it's such a great movie that everybody has seen it, but maybe not. But really, you don't have to know the plot of the thing. It's about labor unions on the waterfront in New York, corrupt labor unions. And from the very beginning in the movie, which has Marlon Brando in it, and also Eva Marie Saint, who I promptly fell in love with. Well, I had to see the movie 7 times, you see. You can't see Eva Marie Saint 7 times without falling in love with her. So from the very beginning of the movie, everything just goes wrong for everybody, and the character played by Eva Marie Saint falls in love with the character played by Marlon Brando, and of course, you know, it's fated not to be able to happen. Everything just gets worse and worse through the movie. There's one thing, since I'm reading this, if you saw it on the page, you wouldn't have to remember this, but the epigraph to the poem is Know Thyself, and if you would please keep in mind that the Latin for know thyself is Nosce te ipsum. On the waterfront. I stand, flashlight in hand, just inside the door, in my starched white shirt, red jacket nailed shut by 6 gold buttons, and a plastic black bow tie, a sort of smaller movie screen reflecting back the larger one. "Is that really you?" says Mrs. Pierce, my Latin teacher. As I lead her to her seat between the Nederlands, our neighbors, and Mickey Breen, who owns the liquor store. Walking back, I see their faces bright and childlike in the mirrored glare of a tragic winter New York sky. I know them all, these small town worried faces, these natives of the known, the real, a highway and brown fields. And New York is a foreign land, the waterfront, unions, priests, the tugboats moan, exotic as Siam or Casablanca. I have seen this movie 7 times. Memorized the lines. Edie, raised by nuns, pleading, praying really, isn't everyone a part of everybody else? And Terry, angry, stunned with guilt, quit worrying about the truth, worry about yourself, while I, in this one movie Kansas town where everyone is a part of everybody else, am waiting darkly for a self to worry over, a name, a place, New York, on 52nd Street between the Five Spot and Jimmy Ryan's, where bebop and blue neon lights would fill my room and I would wear a pork pie hat and play tenor saxophone like Lester Young. But now, however, I am lost. And Edie, too, and Charlie, Father Barry, Pop, even Terry, because he worried more about the truth than he did about himself. And I scan the little mounds of bodies now lost even to themselves as the movie rushes to its end, car lights winging down an alley, quick shadows fluttering across this east river of familiar faces like storm clouds cluttering a wheat field or geese in autumn plowing through the sun, that honking, that moan of a boat in fog. I walk outside to cop a smoke. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of who I am. And look across the street at the Army-Navy store where we would try on gas masks and Elmer Fox would let us hold the Purple Hearts. But it's over now and they are leaving. Good night, Mr. Nederland. Good night, Mrs. Nederland. Good night, Mick. Good night, Mrs. Pierce. As she, a woman who has lived alone for 40 years, and for 2 of those has suffered through my botched translations from the Latin tongue, smiles, nosce te ipsum, and I have no idea what she means. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.